The opioid epidemic is growing again, and evictions could begin next month. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Palm Beach County faces an uphill battle against opioids. The pandemic is worsening the problem. How will the state use millions from the massive pharmaceutical settlement? Also, the eviction moratorium is about to end. What could happen to the thousands of Floridians who have been unable to pay rent during the pandemic?
One of the fears I have, courts may be so overburdened with cases that they're going to try to rush through them.
We have a panel on what comes next for those hanging on to their apartment or home. And finally, July 26 is an important day in Cuba's history. We'll hear about its significance and why July 11th may become a vital day for Cubans. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. Coronavirus cases are continuing to rise in Florida while another public health crisis is ongoing. Opioid overdose deaths are on the rise nationwide, and Palm Beach County last year saw a 23% increase from 2019. The majority of deaths stem from the powerful opioid called fentanyl. The state is about to get significant financial support from a major settlement against drug companies. Joining us now is Dave Ehrenberg, the Palm Beach County State Attorney. Mr. Ehrenberg, thank you so much for joining us. You know, given the unprecedented health crisis presented by the pandemic, to what extent has the county been able to manage the opioid crisis at the same time?
And thanks for having me on. It is a challenge because a lot of people have forgotten about the opioid epidemic in the face of this global pandemic. But the global pandemic didn't make the epidemic go away. In fact, it made it worse. It made it worse because you had less face-to-face contact, more social isolation, fewer group counseling sessions, and that led to more overdose deaths. And you have the rise of fentanyl. Today's opioid epidemic is now a fentanyl epidemic. And 95% of all of our overdoses here in Palm Beach County have fentanyl involved. And so when you ask about what is Palm Beach County doing, the county has done a few innovative things. And one of them is to create a unit at JFK Hospital North called the Addiction Stabilization Unit, or ASU, that tries to break the cycle of addiction. Because when people overdose, they get sent to the emergency room and then they get released only to overdose again. And again, and sometimes they overdose in the hospital's own parking lot after they're released. But the ASU tries to break that cycle through follow-up care and using medication-assisted treatment to stop the addiction. It's an innovative approach, and we're hoping to see results. But right now, we're in the midst of this increase because of fentanyl and because we're coming out of this, well, we're still involved, actually, in this pandemic.
Yeah, and we keep talking about this, the issue of fentanyl, and I'm wondering, how is that getting into the county? Have you been able to identify sources?
Fentanyl comes into the United States mainly through two ways. First, it comes in through shipments from China. China is the largest manufacturer of fentanyl by far. And so it comes in through the U.S. Postal Service. Now, there was a recent law that passed to try to get tough on that, to try to require the Postal Service to know their customer. And that seems to have had a little bit of an impact. But what has happened is that, by all accounts, the Chinese manufacturers are sending it, instead of as fentanyl, it's sending it in different forms to be compounded, like it's the ingredients to be compounded by the recipient, who then sells it on the street. And so that's one way to do it, through direct shipments. The other thing is it gets smuggled into the southern border. We are seeing that. The drug cartels know that this is a big item, and there's a lot of demand for it, because with the opioid epidemic, fentanyl allows drug dealers to spike these drugs, heroin and other drugs, with a cheaper, much more potent drug in fentanyl that decreases the price to them and increases the pop for the end user. And that's why you have so many new deaths.
So Governor DeSantis announced that the state is going to be getting $1.3 billion of this $26 billion opioid settlement. Do you know how much Palm Beach County is going to be receiving from that?
I don't know the exact amount. I hope that Palm Beach County will get its fair share. I don't know the kind of formula that the state is creating to distribute it throughout the state. This is, this settlement obviously is important because we need the funds. The county had a lot of unreimbursed costs to pay for this opioid epidemic. Just think of all the firefighters and ambulances and the Narcan, which is the drug used to reverse an overdose, all those man hours that were unreimbursed. And this is a man-made epidemic. I mean, this is an epidemic created by corporate America through corporate malfeasance, namely Purdue Pharma, which really invented the opioid epidemic when it introduced OxyContin onto the market in 1996. So make no mistake, this epidemic was entirely preventable. It was never inevitable. It was created by corporate malfeasance, by professional greed, by political apathy, and by regulatory failure.
And one of the interesting things about this is that there are a number of states and cities like Washington, West Virginia, Philadelphia. They're rejecting the money because they argue that the companies don't have to admit wrongdoing. They see that $26 billion as being too little anyway. Do you think Florida should take that same route?
You know, I've been working in this area for many years. In fact, when I was with the Florida Attorney General's office under Bob Butterworth, I was the first in the country to investigate Purdue Pharma, the manufacturer of OxyContin. That was back in 2001. And sadly, things just got worse from there, even after settlements, even after they faced criminal charges by the federal authorities. And as far as whether states, including Florida, should reject the settlement money, you know, my instinct is that the individuals who helped create this unprecedented epidemic should be held accountable criminally, that there are too few corporate executives who ever wore a pair of handcuffs because of their role in creating this epidemic that continues to kill 190 people every day just from opioids alone. 190 people will die today because of that. And yeah, I can understand why it's frustrating that the Purdue Pharma doesn't have to accept responsibility. The drug distributors who entered into the settlement don't have to accept responsibility. I think they should. And I think more people should be arrested. And I think the number of dollars should be more. But I don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good. And so that's why I'm, you know, withholding judgment, because I wasn't part of the settlement agreement. And so, you know, those people who negotiated it, they know better than I what is necessary and what they could get.
And look, if they don't have to admit any wrongdoing, then what's stopping any of these manufacturers from just continuing to make more?
Well, in fact, the Purdue Pharma settlement, the settlement everyone is talking about, allows them to pay for the settlement using money that they will gain by selling their addictive drugs overseas. So essentially, they will be exporting our opioid epidemic overseas so that they can help pay for the cost of the epidemic here, to help pay for the settlement. So yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I would love for them. They should be forced to admit accountability and responsibility for this. There's too little accountability when it comes to this epidemic. I just, you know, I just hesitate to put myself in the shoes of those negotiators, because, you know, I don't know what's going through their minds. I know they were motivated by the right reasons, and maybe they just decided this is the only way they're going to get civil money, and it does not foreclose later accountability, perhaps by criminal prosecutors or by others, because this is not a total global settlement. It's a partial settlement.
I will mention, too, part of that settlement, my understanding is that Johnson & Johnson cannot manufacture any opioids for the next 10 years. That's just my understanding, but I'll double check on that. Talking again with Dave Ehrenberg, the Palm Beach County State Attorney. Again, Palm Beach County seeing a massive uptick in opioid overdose deaths over the course of 2020. The pandemic not helping out in any way. Find more on the county's approach, by the way, on this crisis. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. So, Mr. Ehrenberg, let me switch over to the pandemic again, because now we're seeing surging numbers in the state. The state now accounting for 20% of all new cases nationwide. If Palm Beach County wanted to implement any new COVID safety protocols, to what extent are they able to do that, given the governor's limiting laws?
Right. The governor in the last session made himself the really commander in chief in all of this, where he has essentially preempted local governments, limited what they can do. In fact, when there was talk that local school districts are going to implement mask mandates for students, he threatened to call a special session of the legislature to overrule those if he didn't have the power himself to do so. And it just is very telling that with COVID cases spiking, with one out of every five COVID cases in the country coming from Florida, think about that, that the governor is refusing to call a special session to deal with that, with the exception of calling a special session to prevent mask mandates in our schools, because the governor is solely motivated by one thing, and that is to become the 2024 Republican nominee for president. And so far, he's succeeding on that track.
Could private companies face legal challenges if they require their employees to be vaccinated or to wear masks indoors?
I don't think so. I think private companies have the right to govern themselves. I mean, it's amazing that those who tried to restrict private companies from doing things, like the governor signed a law that he pushed to force cruise companies to prevent them from asking passengers for proof of vaccinations. So, you know, I guess he was okay to allow these companies to be floating Petri dishes in the ocean, but the companies are suing, at least Norwegian Cruise Lines is suing based on the First Amendment, based on the fact that the government is impeding its ability to communicate with its own customers. So I think the private companies should win these. I think that private companies should be able to deal with their customers in their own way and their own employees, because they're not government, they are private. And you know, it is ironic that the same people like Governor DeSantis who love to condemn the evils of socialism sure love laws that look very socialist.
Well, you know what, and it comes down, the other question is this: what powers do the local governments have right now? What powers do you have right now, you know, when you're dealing with the issue of COVID? Because again, during the last legislative session, they did a lot of work to try to take local power away.
Exactly. And that's why these laws may need to be tested to under home rule and under state constitution. What
are
is
there,
the
are there any plans to challenge them?
I don't know. League of Cities and the Florida Association of Counties would have to make that decision whether they would do a lawsuit, because as the COVID epidemic spirals out of control here, local governments are under a lot of pressure to do something. And they're pointing to Tallahassee saying, hey, Tallahassee took most of our authority away. So that is a state of flux right now. And that's something that's going to have to be sorted out. But it's crazy that in the midst of this pandemic that we're dealing with these questions over the, you know, legalities of local ordinances versus state laws when people need help. In fact, the governor should call a state of emergency for what's going on right now. But instead, he's decided to, you know, make other things a priority.
Dave Ehrenberg is the Palm Beach County State Attorney. Again, we were talking earlier about the opioid challenges. Again, those numbers going up during the pandemic. Pandemic numbers now, COVID cases going up as well. And you can check out all our coverage on this on our website at WLRN.org. Mr. Ehrenberg, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, still to come, as July comes to a close, so do protections against evictions. We have a panel conversation coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Many residents could lose their house or apartment as the federal evictions moratorium comes to an end this month. The Biden administration has said those protections for people who are unable to pay rent would not be renewed. Experts warn that the amount of eviction cases that will come out of this has the potential to overwhelm the legal system and public resources, like homeless shelters and hospitals. I want to welcome a panel conversation on this issue. First, I want to start with Lake Worth Beach Commissioner Kim Stokes. Also joining us is Legal Aid Society of Palm Beach County staff attorney Danita Jones and Daniela Pierre. She's the president of the Miami-Dade branch of the NAACP and a housing advocate. I want to thank all of my guests. Thank you for the time today. Daniela, I want to start with you. I wondered, how have you seen the pandemic affect the access to housing in this area? What have you seen?
Thanks for the question. The pandemic has definitely impacted many of our residents here within Miami-Dade County. Longstanding, we've always had barriers to entry. So where there was low income, low wealth, and just the cost factor of what it takes to actually afford somewhere to rent and or purchase. Most recently, though we know that the eviction moratorium is slated to end this month, there are currently over 4,000 pending evictions within Miami-Dade County. So it has impacted many families with either going without care for health, shortage on foods. That's why we still have our wide share of farm share initiatives going on in our counties. And those things are impacting the families day to day.
And Daniela, those thousands of evictions you mentioned, pending evictions, are those because of the pandemic or was those before the pandemic?
Yeah, those were actually filed back in March 1 of 2020, and that goes to May 31, 2021. So those are currently pending within Miami-Dade County.
And just, I'm curious, Daniela, what are you most worried about as this eviction moratorium comes to an end? What do you think is going to happen?
Most worried about, many of those families that are in that number of over 4,000 were already renter and cost burden to pay that amount. If those evictions go through, where will they go? Because they could not already afford to live where they were living. And the availability of affordable homes is slim to none. There is a known shortage throughout the entire state of Florida that there's not the availability to reach the supply and demand needed. So if we don't get an extension, or if there are no new initiatives to actually pay the arrearage to landlords, I'm not certain what those families will be able to do. It's a lot of unreadiness and unstableness as we approach back to school. These families are scared.
Commissioner Stokes, I wanted to get a sense from you up in Palm Beach County and in your town in Lake Worth Beach. What are you hearing about this eviction moratorium coming to an end? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, thank you for having me. I agree with Danielle. I'm very concerned about families getting noticed that they have to find a new place to live and not having access to the resources that they need or to representation that they need to help them navigate this process. I'm worried that it's going to be a very stressful process, and tenants just don't even know what their rights are and they don't know where to turn. I'm worried about their children who, as you said, school is getting ready to start up, and it's very hard for us to expect our students to thrive in school when they don't have a safe home that they're guaranteed to stay in. So I am also worried about the uptick in homelessness and things like that, because we don't have a lot of places for them to go to. And I think the most important thing I want to see us do is try to support them in working out an agreement with their landlord. The best case scenario is that they can stay where they are.
And Commissioner, I'm wondering, because you've been pushing to get more funding for legal help for low-income residents who are going to be most affected by this moratorium coming to an end. What's happening with that? Have you heard anything?
So we are, our city attorney is supposed to be working on a contract with legal aid to expand our access to their services and bring it back to our August 3rd meeting for a vote. I was hoping it would come before the end of July, but there's a sense, because the county is ramping up to prepare for this, there's kind of a sense with some of my peers and even our city attorney that the county has it covered and, you know, the city doesn't really need to worry about it. But I don't share that sentiment. I'm really worried that the legal aid is going to get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And I want us to do our part to help.
You've faced pushback from other commissioners. They're not convinced that spending money from the American Rescue Plan Act on this is the way to go. They say that there are already organizations providing that help. And, Danita Jones, you work for one of those organizations. Do you see the need for these extra resources?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so very much for having me. I do see the need. We do not know how many people the lifting of the eviction moratorium will impact. And I echo with what Ms. Pierre and Commissioner Stokes has said. It could have an immense impact on our children and our families, in Palm Beach County. I will tell you that we definitely need all hands on deck. The county is working quickly to review applications and get outstanding balances owed to landlords paid. Legal aid and Florida Rural Legal Services serve as neutral mediators during case management conferences in order to facilitate the settlement of eviction cases. And then here at Legal Aid, our office continues to represent clients who are facing evictions for various reasons. Our Rapid Response Eviction Assistance Program also assists with applying for emergency rental assistance through the county. And we also have funds available for individuals living in Palm Beach County that are undocumented. But whatever help, whatever services are out there and are available, I definitely see a need for it.
And Commissioner Stokes, I got to come back to you because you said there are people who don't know where to turn. And I'm just thinking, where's that information? Is it not easily, readily available, or is it some people just have a hard time finding it?
I think that some people have a hard time finding it. And sometimes the people like myself who are working at a city hall, we're not on the same platforms. We're not on the same social media. We're not in the same circles as the people that need access to this information. So I was asking the city to fund a little bit more outreach and do some mailers to push that information out. And we are actually going to, me and some local do-gooders are going to go out and start trying to go door to door in some of these rental complexes just to get that information out to them, which I think will in turn bring more people to legal aid and bring more people to these services. So they're going to see their cases increase.
Daniela Pierre, I'm wondering what you're hearing from people who may be facing evictions at the end of this month. We're rapidly coming up to the end here. What do they need most right now? I wondered if there's a particular story of maybe somebody you might share.
What we're hearing now, residents are having a hard time applying for rental assistance and for various reasons. And there's also a hard time for landlords to actually receive those dollars. There are many reports that are saying the state of Florida is having a hard time distributing emergency relief funding. But we do encourage everyone to visit ourflorida.com, where they can apply for rental assistance as well as utilities relief. That's an online application. Now, that might not be the best way for many of our vulnerable populations to apply for rental assistance. So we do appreciate where those paper applications exist, but we also need accountability for that funding to actually apply to erase the rental arrearage. So many of our residents here are very concerned that they're not getting those funds to come back and clear that debt owed. They still have that pending eviction hanging over their head, but we need to bring those things together so that families are able to begin to hopefully live again amidst this pandemic.
We're talking with Daniela Pierre. She's the president of the Miami-Dade branch of the NAACP and a housing advocate. We're also speaking with Danita Jones, a staff attorney at the Legal Aid Society of Palm Beach County, and Lake Worth Beach Commissioner Kim Stokes. And we're talking about the federal eviction moratorium that's coming to an end this week after multiple extensions over the past year. Again, the Biden administration has said the moratorium would not be renewed again. Millions across the country could lose their homes or be thrown out of their apartments because of this. You can find more of our reporting on how the pandemic has impacted housing and resources for aid on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Commissioner Stokes, I know that time constraints here with you, but I wanted to ask you, have you seen any other cities or counties around the state or around the country that invest in this way? They've been successful getting more funding for tenants' legal representation.
I haven't seen anything locally here, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But I haven't seen anything locally here. I know there are cities like Denver and other larger cities that are trying to guarantee a right to counsel for anyone making up to 80% of the average median income. So that there are other cities that are doing this. The challenge is that Lake Worth is small. We can't fund anything on a large scale. And we do need to partner with the county and the services that they provide.
And you were talking about a moment ago going door to door in some cases, but again, we're coming up to the end of this month. I mean, it's right here. This is a very stressful time for a lot of people. What's next for you besides that? What more can you do in that short time?
I'm just continuing to advocate for more outreach. I know we have staff that is also coordinating outreach with maybe some of the local churches and some other community centers. So we're going to do our typical outreach, our known places to push into. And just anything extra we can do on top of that, we're going to try to do. We do have the rental assistance bus coming to Lake Worth this Friday.
And Commissioner, I mean, look, we're all wondering, you know, when this finally, the moratorium ends, you know, what could it mean? And there's always that fear that you're going to have a lot of new homeless, but what is your biggest fear? And do you think that, you know, we can avoid it?
Yeah, my biggest fear is, even if we don't see a rush of people living on the streets, I mean, homeless takes so many forms. It's people that are in motels. It's just that instability, that eviction on your record that makes their life so much harder to try to get into another place. I'm just worried about the lasting effects on each individual that's going to go through the eviction process and what it could mean for them.
Commissioner Stokes, I really appreciate your time. I know that you're tight on time and got a lot going on today. Thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn back over to my other panelists. Danita, I want to start with you. We've seen the eviction moratorium extended multiple times. What indication do we have that maybe it won't be extended again?
Yes. So in the most recent order issued by the CDC, they made it very clear that they did not intend to extend the CDC's moratorium. We have to remember that the CDC's moratorium was implemented as a result of the public health emergency. And its intention was to keep people in their homes and out of crowded or congregate settings like homeless shelters by preventing evictions. So that was the purpose of it. I don't believe that it will be extended.
How are you getting ready for potentially an overwhelming number of eviction cases? What do you think is going to happen?
You know, it's hard to say. The CDC eviction moratorium in and of itself did not prohibit the filing of evictions. It prohibited the final action of actually forcing the tenant to vacate the property from taking place. And so I expect that many cases that are in its final stages, the writ of possession will be issued in those cases. But at the same time, we also encourage tenants to contact us to help with the legal representation in court and to help with the applying for rental assistance through the county's emergency rental assistance program in order to prevent the eviction from actually happening.
And Danita, you know, the other thing too, and we've heard this throughout the past year and a half, is sometimes you just have to talk to your landlord and maybe you can come up with a deal. Because obviously it's going to hurt them too. But I mean, how often do you run into people who they don't know how to approach a landlord on this or they're too scared to?
It happens. Tenants are often afraid. They're uncomfortable to approach their landlord. I know that at Legal Aid, we help facilitate that process and we engage in pre-negotiations with the landlord. When I say pre-negotiations, pre-filing of an eviction negotiation with the landlord. And once the landlord understands that our goal is to keep the tenant housed and also to make sure that they receive the funds that are due to them, then they are more accepting of our services or of the services and of the rental assistance that's offered.
Daniela, you know, during a time like this, people facing eviction, they're on their own when it comes to navigating the legal system. On the other side, landlords usually have legal counsel. Doesn't seem like a level playing field. How do we make that? How do we change that?
That's always been the case. It always been an uneven playing field when it came to landlords and tenants. A lot of groups have partnered up. Legal Services Greater Miami, we have the Miami Workers Center, and many other groups have partnered up to help empower tenants by hosting Know Your Rights workshops. Many of those, they go through the Florida state statutes to let those tenants know their rights and encourage them to begin the conversations with their landlords. It's very important for the renters to know their rights, which are already codified in state statute 83, so that they can be able to speak with the landlords. By the same token, many landlords want to have that open door, but there is this type of fear and resistance and retaliation that renters feel, that if they say they can't pay their rent or they can't pay it, then they're going to be scrutinized, not just in the place they're living in, but places to come, because that follows them as a track record. So we are very mindful of what's going on. So those Know Your Rights protection workshops, and just hopefully getting landlords and tenants to have some type of common ground to protect and preserve their living situations for today and tomorrow.
And Daniela, interestingly enough, you've had personal experience, you know, losing your home.
Oh, yes.
How did that impact, you know, you, and what's it been like getting back from that?
I'm still impacted to this very day. You know, I lost my home about 7 years ago to foreclosure because I lost my job. And I never knew that the rental world was so limited in terms of opportunities and availability, even with having a degree. You shouldn't have to have a certain type of degree or pedigree to be able to afford to rent somewhere. But that what is society is saying. Society says that you get a higher education, you should be able to live anywhere. Well, I don't think that's true, because I'm someone with that education that still is not able to affordably live within my community. So it has a big impact on myself and my children, and many others who've gone through that struggle, whether it's losing their home through foreclosure and or evictions. It's really a devastating time, and trying to recover, it just takes a lot of time, a lot of time.
And so what advice do you have for people who might be facing eviction? What do you tell them right now?
The advice that I have for those who may be facing eviction, number one, you want to definitely work out a plan of understanding. If nothing else, work out a plan of understanding with your landlord. See if they're able to make some adjustments. See if they're able to put what you owe towards the back. Come with some solutions, not just that I can't pay. Come with some solutions as to a repayment plan. Find out a repayment strategy. Talk about applying to those emergency rental assistance programs through ourflorida.com. And if you live in the city of Miami, they may have some opportunities as well. But bring all those options when you meet with your landlord to see what can be done. Once you have that conversation, follow back up in writing to make certain that whatever was stated verbally can stand up in writing. And if you have to move forward, at least you have some proof of what was discussed and, more importantly, agreed upon.
Danita, we finish up here, you know, not to say till we have to understand the landlord side of this as well. I mean, you know, they were impacted by the pandemic as well. They may lose, you know, properties and investments. I'm wondering what you're hearing from them as to how this is, you know, this eviction moratorium is affecting them. And are they open to talking to their tenants?
Well, we're hearing exactly what you just stated, that they are in fear that they're not able to pay the mortgages on their property. However, I always encourage the landlords to understand that with patience and negotiation, we can help at Legal Aid Society of Palm Beach County, the tenant apply for funding and receive that funding if they qualify, and that in receiving it, they'll be able to put that towards their arrears.
Danita Jones is a staff attorney at the Legal Aid Society of Palm Beach County. Oh, we also heard from Daniela Pierre. She's the president of the Miami-Dade branch of the NAACP and a housing advocate. And we heard earlier from Lake Worth Beach Commissioner Kim Stokes. And again, the eviction moratorium, national eviction moratorium, coming to an end at the end of this month. Keep following that story on our website at WLRN.org. Daniela, Danita, thank you so much for the time and all the information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, we'd love to hear from you. Maybe this is impacting you, whether you're a tenant, whether you're a landlord. We want to hear your story. That's what Sundial is about. Here's the best way to do it. Join the Sundial Text Club. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, just type hello to 786-677-0767. Well, still to come, 68 years ago marked the beginning of the Cuban Revolution. The importance of July 26 as protests against the regime continue. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Today marks 68 years since the start of the Cuban Revolution. It's a day of celebration for the communist government. But for the people, this year is different. Cubans from South Florida and all over the world are in the streets protesting against the regime that came out of that revolution. The unrest was sparked by the historic pro-democracy protest that broke out on the island July 11th. Joining us now is Sebastian Arcos. He is the Associate Director of the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University. Sebastian, it's a pleasure to have you, and I wanted to start with this. I wanted you to remind us of what happened on this day back in 1953, and why is today an important date in Cuban history?
On July 26, 1953, Fidel Castro led a group of Cubans in attacking the second most important military barracks in Cuba, the Moncada Barracks in Santiago de Cuba. Santiago de Cuba is on the eastern side of the island, the second largest city in Cuba. Fidel Castro was a young man, a lawyer, very ambitious, and he was looking to get into Cuban politics. And the best way for him to find notoriety and to get launched into politics in Cuba, he decided to attack the barracks in the morning of July 26th with about 200 men, which included, by the way, one of my uncles, who was sitting right behind him as he drove his car into the barracks. The attack was a failure. They could not take the barracks, of course, and many of his followers were killed in action, and many of them were apprehended and killed, assassinated afterwards. He was very lucky. He escaped unharmed, and he was arrested by a decent military man who put him under the protection of the church in Santiago de Cuba. So he was protected. He went to trial, and he was sentenced to 15 years in jail for attacking the barracks. He was released barely 2 years later. In a general amnesty. And then he went to Mexico and organized a landing in Sierra Maestra, and the rest is history.
Yeah. And by the way, with your uncle who was there with him, what happened to him?
He was wounded, seriously wounded in the attack. From that point on, he had a limp on his right leg. He went to prison alongside Castro. He went to Mexico alongside Castro. He was one of the founders of Castro's 26th of July movement. He didn't land in Cuba. He couldn't catch the boat before the boat left. That probably saved his life because he couldn't hike the mountains like the others did. He eventually became a Cuban ambassador to Belgium and Luxembourg, but he was not a communist. And when he realized that Fidel Castro was turning towards communism, he came back to Cuba. He complained. He demanded to see Fidel Castro, and he ended up in jail.
And again, the story that you told about the attacks on the barracks, I mean, that was almost 6 years before 1959, and then eventually Castro took power in Cuba. And I wondered, you know, when you think about that day, you know, July 26th, how the Cuban people on the island viewed that day.
Well, the Cuban people just didn't have a say in turning 26th of July into a national celebration. That was Fidel Castro's mission. Notice something. There's a pattern here. He attacked the Moncada barracks on 26th of July, and that became the most important holiday in Cuba. Christmas was canceled. All the national holidays passed to a secondary position. The second most important celebration in today's Cuba is January the 1st, which is, guess what, the day Fidel Castro finally was declared the victor in the fight against Batista. This is the typical personality cult that Fidel Castro created around himself. Everything that happened in Cuba before his revolution was either not important or was a lead to his revolution. He was the most important thing in Cuba. He was the most important thing that happened to Cuba was himself. And he managed to make sure that everybody celebrated his victories and his historical landmark.
So you have July 26th and then January 1st. What's different about those dates this year?
Cubans on Sunday, July 11, didn't need anybody to tell them to go out into the streets, didn't need anybody to lead them into the streets. They just exploded into the streets because they are tired of lies. They are tired of misery. They are tired of people telling them to sacrifice for the future when they have been waiting for that future for 60-some years, at the same time that they can see that the people asking them to sacrifice lead the lives of millionaires. It's the lie of communism and socialism that they have endured for 60 years, and they are just tired of it. And they went out demanding what they know is they need, freedom. And I can guarantee you that once this nightmare is over for Cubans, the date that they will celebrate in July will no longer be July 26th. It will be July 11th.
And I want to ask you a little bit about that. Again, talking with Sebastian Arcos, the Associate Director of the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University. Again, July 26th, for decades, this day has been celebrated by the Cuban government, commemorating the start of the revolution. You can find more of our reporting, by the way, on those protests on July 11th coming out of Cuba on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, Sebastian, during your time in Cuba, you were part of the Cuban Committee for Human Rights. That's the first independent Cuban human rights organization. What was it like doing that kind of work on the island at the time?
You're right. I'm very proud of that. I was very young, and I joined a very small group of people who founded that very first group that we didn't know at the time, but eventually became the origin of the very large, very extensive human rights movement that now exists in Cuba. It was a difficult decision, but I still believe it was the right decision. We knew that it was an uphill battle against a totalitarian regime that controls every aspect of Cuban society, media, the courts, everything. But we didn't do it just because we thought that we were going to win in a matter of 2 or 3 or 5 years. We did it because we thought that is the best way that we could live our lives as free individuals and that we could find our own human dignity by doing what we believe was right. It was difficult, and at some times was absolutely exhilarating when, for example, when the Berlin Wall fell and all the communist countries in Europe liberated one after the other. For us, it was simply exhilarated because we believed that history was proving us right.
And you said a moment ago, win. What does that mean to you?
Win meaning bringing democracy back to the island, bringing freedom back to the island, allowing Cubans to live in peace in their own land and to make their own life as they see fit, and to build a country that is a decent place to live, a country that is prosperous, a country where you are not persecuted for praying to a god or believing in this or that ideology or reading this or that book. That's what I mean winning. And I think Cubans today have a very clear idea that that is the country that they want.
So do
not
you...
the country that the regime has been telling them for 60 years that they have already achieved. That is not true, clearly.
Do you think that these protests, this movement right now, is a legitimate threat to the regime?
It is the gravest threat to the regime that they have ever encountered. It is far more dangerous than the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. It is definitely the biggest threat because it's coming from the bottom up. It's coming from the population as a whole. And it has destroyed, in my opinion, for good, the image of legitimacy that the regime had built so carefully over 60 years of propaganda and control of the media and information in Cuba. That image has been destroyed for good. It cannot be put together again. And if it's not tomorrow or next month or even next year, but Cubans will go back out into the streets and the regime will have to face that.
And I wondered because, look, the Cuban government is doing its best to try to crack down on these protests, arresting people, having these summary trials. People are disappearing. I mean, in Cuba, how long do you think the people there can keep up that dissent, keep up that fight?
No one knows. No one can tell for sure. I have hopes that people understand that this is their moment, this is their opportunity, and that they can go back out again and demand peacefully, without any kind of violence, the rights that are theirs. And I think they should understand that the regime right now is very much afraid, that all this repression that we're watching, that is the one thing that the regime is very efficient at, is repressing and persecuting people and punishing people, but they are very close to losing control of their own followers. And if people go out into the streets again, they will force the regime to move either in one direction or the other. Either they will move into reform, which is what they ought to be doing now, or they will move farther into a harsher repression that will eventually lead to a regime collapse. I think it's inevitable.
Sebastian, just in the short time that I have briefly, what role do you think the U.S. should play in this?
Well, the U.S. has very limited possibilities of influencing what's happening inside Cuba. What's happening inside Cuba is due to its own dynamics, and it has very little, if anything, to do with U.S. policy. U.S. must make very clear that it stands with the Cuban people, with the right that they have to seek their own future, and that it stands ready to assist as soon as Cuba has a transition government. I think the U.S. should be encouraging the idea that a transition, a peaceful transition to democracy, is the best solution not only for Cubans, but for the entire hemisphere.
Sebastian Arcos, he's the Associate Director of the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University. Sebastian, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
And that is our program for this Monday, July 26th. We may not have a program tomorrow due to NPR special coverage beginning at 9:30. We're going to bring you anchor network coverage of the first congressional hearings on the January 6th Capitol insurrection. We'll also have updates for you on All Things Considered as the hearings progress. But coming up on Wednesday, Thomas James is serving a prison sentence for the murder of a man in Coconut Grove. The problem is James has never been to the Grove. He lived in Miami's Brownsville neighborhood. The cover story of GQ explores the improbable story of mistaken identity in James's fight for freedom. That's coming up Wednesday on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.